Hello, everyone, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap here on August the 3rd, 2016, the first week of Blogist!
Blogist!
I'm Nick, this is Chris. We're going to be talking about a lot of Bleach-related things over the course of this month as we tick down towards the conclusion of Kubo Tite's famous manga. And, I did not think that this was going to happen quite so early, honestly. I figured that we would... This time last year, I figured we might be doing Blogist next year, you know?
Because I thought there was some quote of Kubo saying that he wasn't expecting to end in 2016. Like, he still had a lot more to do.
No, I think that news has been, like, shifting. Like, there were some people who thought it was going to be over in 2015, and then it became obvious, of course, that it wasn't going to. No one's really had an exact timetable until literally just a week ago. And even then, that exact timetable was wrong. Yeah. So it turns out that it's going to be ending in like 3 weeks as opposed to next week. But whatever. We'll cover it. We're going to talk about Bleach. But are you looking forward to this, Chris?
I'm looking forward to Blogist. I'm a very sentimental kind of person, mm-hmm. So I always like the chance to like look back and over like kind of view something in an overall manner. Like I like that with Naruto, being able to like look back at through the entire series, talk about its final moment, then conclude it all together, then like wax, you know, nostalgic on just our favorite parts and what went good, what went bad. Like I love that kind of stuff. Like being able mm-hmm. to just overview and recap an entire 15-plus-year series. I think mm-hmm. that's awesome. So,
Naruto Vember a couple years ago was a lot of fun, too. And
I'm looking forward to this. This one has a slightly more bittersweet taste to it, just because it's not ending, per se, on its own terms. And mm-hmm. it's kind of going off in a weird point. But I'm still excited for it. I'm really excited because to prepare for some of the upcoming weeks, I'm going to be going through and reading through Bleach again, so I'm going to be able to enjoy some of those early arcs I enjoyed so much. So I'm looking forward to that, if nothing else.
Yeah. Similar to what we did with Naruto Vember, where our first week we did something Naruto-related in order to cover for one of our series, we're doing that again this time with Bleach. Yes. And we're going to be covering Kubo's...
Can't see it that well, but I have it on here.
Well, and also, you went to your home screen before.
Yeah, I tapped it. I'm a fool. Good job. I'm a big dummy, Nick.
So, this time we're going to be covering Kubo's first manga, the first one that he had run in Shonen Jump, which is called Zombie Powder, which has...
Zombie Powder, spelled with a one word and a period at the end, like all titles are.
It's so weird because it's not a sentence. It's just one word. Hmm. And then a period.
We're going to be talking about this, I'm sure, in depth once we get into the actual series. But I love this manga. I read through it because it shows you that like the Kuboisms that we've come to establish with his persona are not something that like developed over time. He's had them going as far back as the 90s. Because if you read through this series, there's so many... There are almost better chapter titles in this than there are in Bleach. There's so many just absolutely batshit crazy ones. Like, Call Howl, I'm Jesus, or something like that. Deceiving Jet Joe. Just, like, weird things that apply almost in no way, shape, or form to the actual chapter at hand. And yet are just so awesome. It's... Pierce me standing in the fire garden.
Apparently a lot of them are
can't
like,
howl my inner Jesus.
Apparently they're like inspired by rock song
I think
titles.
So
which I mean, that's not too surprising. Kubo listens to a lot of rock music and you can see a lot of that influence in Bleach with a lot even with the names that he comes up with in Bleach.
The hyenas are calling, parentheses, craze and trigger happy.
Mm-hmm. All right. So this is Kubo's first big manga. There are problems with it. It's... But there are also some really good things about it, I think. It's kind of a weird mixed basket, and it's really difficult to read it without making comparisons to Bleach. Especially because their main character, Gamma, is basically, he looks like Ichigo with wearing a Grimmjow cosplay, if that makes sense. He's got Ichigo's very slender, tall build, but he's got Grimmjow's hair. Like, it's just Grimmjow's hair.
Yeah.
And he's got the facial stuff. You can tell that there were, I think, some things in Zombie Powder that Kuo didn't get to do, that he used Bleach to kind of bring a little bit of closure to them, especially when it comes to some elements of Gamma's backstory, which are hinted at but never really explored. Like, Unohan is in this series, I'm pretty sure.
There's a lot of people.
And she's dead. She doesn't come back.
There are actually a lot of characters you look at and you're like, oh, wow, that's, like, this dude. Elwood is kind of, like, very early Ichigo in the face. Mm-hmm. His sister is essentially Ichigo's mom. Like, has the exact same kind of appearance to her. There's other characters, too. There's a character who looks like Soifon very late into the series. Just a lot of, like, small stuff that you can kind of see and be like, oh, I could see where kind of Kubo took that and brought that into this.
Yeah. And in the same vein that if you wanted to be really snarky, you could say that Bleach was clearly written by somebody who had watched a lot of Yu Yu Hakusho. Zombie Power was clearly written by somebody who had watched a lot of Trigun and a lot of Berserk, because it's about a guy who's got a metal arm and a giant sword going through what is essentially the Wild West.
With a huge bounty on his head.
Mm-hmm. Really goofy, but has a deep, dark, hidden past. Yeah. I don't know. I guess let's just go through this. So Gamma is our main character. He's got this huge bounty on his head, and he is seeking out the zombie powder. It's this substance that is created by these 12 rings of death. If you collect them all, you can create zombie powder, and the zombie powder has the ability to bestow life on something. And what that means is, if someone living takes it, it makes them basically immortal. And if you give it to someone who is dead, it brings them back to life. For reasons that are never really fully explained, because the series was canceled so early on, Gamma wants to be immortal. It's implied that, like, he's sick and dying from something, but that's never really fully explored. There is implied that he's got some this like demonic half to him, like a Rurouni Kenshin type of, I used to be this horrible monster who would kill people mercilessly, but now he still kills people mercilessly, but not quite as evilly, I guess. He does kill a lot of people, so I'm not sure exactly what the difference was. It's never really fully explored. And early in the first chapter, Gamma comes across this kid, this teenage pickpocket named Elwood. And Elwood is working for this gang so that he can earn money to help take care of his sick older sister. But by the end of the first chapter, his sister ends up getting killed. And so Elwood goes off with Gamma on his journey to find the Rings of Death so that they can get the zombie powder so that he can bring his sister back to life. At first, it actually seems like there's going to be, like, two co-protagonists. Gamma be, you know, the badass main hero. But a lot of it seems to be from Elwood's perspective as the more normal audience kind of character who's going along with the ride, who's learning to take care of himself because he learns to fight a little bit as the series goes on, and he finds out more about Gamma as we go forward in the story. But as things go along, Elwood really falls out of focus quite a bit, and Gamma definitely just takes center stage. And then we've got some other characters. There's this assassin type character named C.T. Smith who's got a history with Gamma. Don't learn too much about him, just that.
There's not a whole lot of time to learn about much more of the supporting cast. I guess we find out a decent amount about Wolfina.
Well, because her introduction is not about the mystery behind her, it's all about establishing her character and then adding her to the main cast. But then the story just ends, because right when her arc gets finished, her introductory arc gets finished, there's like three more chapters, and the series was canceled. So we get to something that could be considered a bit of an ending point, and then that's just it.
Yes.
It's honestly pretty upsetting, really, because none of the characters are especially unique, but they're likable enough. And I really liked... I came to like Wolfina over the course of her introductory arc, especially right when she first shows up. So to be like, okay, yeah, we've got the gang here, we've got these four different cast members, you know, two of them you know a lot about, two of them you're learning more about. Well, now we've got to end the series, so... And I think the Kubo's inexperience also shows because... And by this point shows because... It really does not end, feel like in any point of any sort whatsoever. You know, a lot of times if a chapter ends, even when a series ends, even within like the first 16 chapters, if they're given a little bit of heads up, they can draw to a concluding point that feels like you could kind of twist it and sort of see like, okay, that's a wrap up. I feel like, okay, that's fine. This one really not so much. It feels really awkward when it does end.
This series as a whole is kind of a weird experiment because there have been stories essentially of how Zombie Powder kind of came to an end. And I bought the volumes digitally, so this comes with a lot of like the extra information. Kubo himself is very forefront and honest in these tankobons, as kind of explaining that this really wasn't a comfortable experience for him. This is at the start of volume 3, so this is like kind of his forward. For certain reasons, I was forced to start Zombie Powder in a shaky emotional state. In the beginning, I was so critical of what I had drawn, I couldn't even bear to look at the finished project. It's only from the third volume onward that I've finally been able to look at my work. All right, read on. This is my manga. So you kind of hear that, and you see a guy who sounds like there may have been some kind of, I don't want to say pressure, but there was some kind of insistence to go forward with it, and he wasn't in the best state of mind. And maybe that kind of explains why a character like Elwood initially seems like he's going to be one thing, and then almost completely disappears after that, because maybe Kubo had a better hold on what he wanted to do with the story then, and that wasn't what he didn't need Elwood for it anymore. Apparently there's a hospital, an ambulance in my room. It's just kind of interesting to sort of see that, and it is sort of a series that has a weird difficulty exactly finding its footing. It seemed like something that kind of wanted to be a strictly action series, but in Kubo's way, it deals very heavily with themes of death and afterlife. But at the same time, it also just has a lot of crazy battles against people with very unique and weird power sets. It's actually kind of refreshing going through this because some of the battles within Zombie Powder are actually really creative and fun in comparison to some of like the my bullshit power is better than your bullshit power that Bleach has sort of become. Like, there's a fight against a guy who throws knives, and he gives a command, and a knife will fly at a numbered target. And you're like, oh, well, it's really easy, just avoid the numbered target he's there now. But then all the targets are actually people that are moving, and it's like this really interesting thing where the targets are kind of manipulating around the hero in that environment to kind of get him in weird angles or hold him together so he gets hit. It's very cool and interesting in that way.
But even the main characters themselves, like, there are definitely aspects of Gamma's fighting style which are reminiscent of Ichigo. Like, it's introduced a few chapters in that he can summon this, like, bizarre black flame ability. It's this, like, super great sword style. And he can summon this black flame, and it's very reminiscent of Ichigo's abilities, because, you know, he's, you know, casting darkness around his stuff. But when he's first introduced, his weapon of choice is introduced as this massive sword which has a chainsaw in the blade. Like, yeah. That's ridiculous. Elwood, the few times he does fight, he fights by throwing knives, which is not something that I see in a lot of shonen manga for a main character to do.
It's very violent and visceral.
It's a very violent series at times, and like I said, a lot of people just get killed mercilessly in this. Lots of arms getting cut off, Cuba didn't change that.
what's somewhat interesting is, again, with these volumes, they started showing some other, like, one-shots or side work Kubo's done in the past. Mm-hmm. And you can see from those that I think Kubo actually wants to write, or at least at that time, had a tendency to want to write more, even more violent series. Because there's a lot of, like, pure dismemberment, bloody, gory kind of stuff in his sides, in his, like, one-shots and, like, side project stuff. So even though this is gory, it's kind of weird when you see the rest of it, you're like, wow, everything else feels restrained because you didn't have, like, guts and blood flying everywhere. It's just the normal Kubo, like, ah, my arm! Drat! I've been slightly hindered.
Yeah. Wolfina, she is introduced as a paparazzi journalist, and she fights with her camera's tripod. Mm-hmm. It's like this modified thing. She, like, uses it to staff fight, but then she also, like, the kickstand shoots out with, like, a rocket and hits people in the face. It's crazy. And really creative, too, because, you know, it's got, you know, a tripod has all these extending and unfolding parts, so another guy is staff fighting her, and she just, and so he, like, blocks it. He's like, I am super skilled at staff fighting! And so she just extends the legs and hits him in the head through his block. I don't know, it's, and you can definitely see that this is something the Kubotite wrote and drew, especially if you compare it to early chapters of Bleach. The style, you can tell that Bleach is where Kubo's art style has evolved, not just if you look between early chapters of Bleach and late chapters of Bleach, but late chapters of Bleach and this series, because there's a lot of similarity between early Bleach and this, especially in terms of like the way his art style morphs when he draws comedic moments is basically the exact same. He'd do this thing where if it were time for a bit of a wacky aside, then the characters' faces would be drawn more scrunched up, and they wouldn't have mouths, they would just have their eyes all, like that. And he does that in this series, he would do it in early Bleach and stuff. And, God, I missed Kubo's actually funny jokes. I really did. There are some funny goddamn moments in this series. When this, you know, Gamma with this dark past he's trying to hide himself is just, you know, going around like he steals some guy's a police cruiser and cuts the top off, and people are like, why don't you stay, you know, just take the train to where we're going, and he's like, I fall asleep on the train, I like to be able to look at the horizon, why are you cutting the roof off of the car, well, I only ride in convertibles. Just these completely weird things that seem almost out of place with his dark badass character, but very much welcome, honestly. Are some of my favorite moments in the series.
I can definitely see that. I was a little surprised, because one thing I always kind of enjoy about early Bleach is I thought that's where Kubo was his best at being a writer. Like, there are aspects of early Bleach that I look at and I'm like, oh, you've managed to tie the mechanics of this world into very interesting, compelling narratives. Like, you know, like Hollows, why they wear masks, and why you're told to always kill them in one blow. Like, that sort of thing where he's really good at kind of writing a story and then making it engaging. I was a little bit surprised because I didn't have any of that same sort of feeling with this series, more or less. Part of it is very much like, oh, this is Trigon meets Rurouni Kenshin, essentially, where it's hard to separate yourself entirely from that, like, of this badass wandering character who's just the best. It's tough to completely divorce your thoughts from that. But just in general, I found myself more engaged by the weirdness or the fights or the smaller stuff necessarily than the actual stories going on within it, because I didn't find all that much that completely engaged me within it.
And honestly, yeah, I mean, like, Kubo has said that one of the ways that he writes the story is if he comes to a block, then he'll make a new character. He'll make a bunch of new characters. Which is one of the biggest problems in Bleach, is that he's got all of these character designs that he's just, you know, throwing around because that's how he writes. But honestly, I think the story with this structure would have worked better for him if it had managed to go on. There are definitely problems with it that I chalk up to inexperience, because, and Kubo has said himself, to build on what you said, about his discomfort writing the story. Apparently, he said that he wasn't as confident in his own ideas, and he allowed editors to interfere in the story a bit too much. So that was why he was upset with, like, the finished product, I guess. And, you know, that's just something that, you know, okay, you know, over time you learn what ideas to reject and what ideas to listen to and so on and so forth. But his main thing of introducing a new character in order to help get the story going, that makes a lot more sense if your main group of characters is going from place to place to place, gathering these rings, going on a journey, then we're going to go to one place to save someone, and that's going to last hundreds of chapters. We're going to go to another place to save someone, and that's going to last hundreds of chapters. We're going to go save the Soul Society, and that's going to take hundreds of chapters. If you're going to different places, you can introduce all these different weird character designs, and it's not as big a deal
It's a case where in this sort of series, the characters are going on an adventure, whereas with Bleach, the adventure needs to come to the characters. Because otherwise, Ichigo and his friends would go back to just living at school, hanging out, doing all that sort of stuff. So it only happens, a plot only happens when a villain shows up to attack one or kidnap one of his friends, basically. And that's kind of where things go from there. So even though Zombie Powder might be a little generic, I definitely could see where it might be more advantageous for him, because he would be able to design new locations, new characters, new themes, all that sort of stuff. It wouldn't have to be inhibited by, like, well, I guess this person's going to have to hang around forever now, too.
Mm-hmm. Why has this character not come back yet? Why is this character not doing anything? That kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Although, this series does still manage to have its own Chad, so... Poor Elwood!
Fuck Elwood. His name's too similar to Ellawood, who's like my least favorite Fire Emblem lord. Ah. So. One thing I will note, there was one character I absolutely adored in this series, and that was the magician. Because he shows up, and, you know, he's kind of revealing himself to be evil, and he just reaches into his ear and pulls out a revolver. Out of fucking nowhere, just, like, pulls it out of his ear and, like, holds it up to somebody. And to this point, things haven't been that crazy in the series. So you're just like, what the fuck is happening? And he just does all this weird shit. He's like, here's a tiger. Poof. Like, fucking, like, just brings a tiger to life. And there's just all this crazy shit going on. I'm like, I love this dude. He's so goofy and weird.
He ends up, like, fighting a Gamma by summoning, like, four extra arms. Yeah, he does all sorts of weird, cool tricks. And he's basically implied to be the closest thing that the series would have had to a recurring villain. Because he escapes at the end and is like, I'll get you next time. But the story ended before he could come back.
Yeah.
There were some really cool things that the characters got to do. There are still some Kubo-isms that show up that apparently he never... For example, Kubo introduces a female character about halfway in called Wolfina. She has giant tits, probably the biggest tits that Kubo has ever drawn, which is amazing. You know, that's fine, whatever. She's nice. She's got a great charisma about her. She's wild and zany and has her own thing going on. She's got her own bags that she's dealing with and her own motivations for doing things. And then it gets to the conclusion of her introductory arc where she's trying to save her brother. And she doesn't win her fights. Women aren't... Female main characters are not allowed to win fights in Kubo's world. Like, Orihime, most powerful, god-defying ability, can't do anything. Completely helpless. This girl, the boss has been beaten. She's fighting, like, the fourth most important minion in this guy's group. Can't beat her. Has to be saved by the guy who is in a coma. It's ridiculous. And that's probably the biggest like, oh, fuck this, that I ever had during the entire manga, was that one moment was like, God damn it, again!
You fucked me over, Kubo, again!
Probably, like, the most interesting character in the whole series doesn't get to have a satisfying conclusion in her own arc. It's her own arc, and she doesn't get to have a triumphant moment. She has to be saved twice. Oh, God.
I would say, to kind of wrap up some of the thoughts of the series, because this isn't a long series
it's to not.
Talk about. It's four volumes, but it's barely even that. Like, the last two volumes are a bit shorter and kind of filled up with extra stuff. And it's something you can kind of get through in an afternoon or an evening. I don't find much value in this series in and of itself. Like, if someone told me, I've never read manga before, but I'm interested in these, you know, couple different factors, I don't know if I'd say, oh, you should read Zombie Powder. I think I'd say, like, oh, you should read Rurouni Kenshin, or you should go read Trigun. I'd tell them to go to that. But I think that there's definitely a lot of value in reading this series if you're someone who's read Bleach and you've read Kubo's stuff and you kind of want to see some interesting insight into where he came before this. Because there's a lot of interesting parallels between this and Bleach, and it's somewhat interesting to see a series he had before this. Because I don't think... I mean, Oda didn't have any long-running series before this. He's had a couple one-shots before One Piece itself, but I don't think he had any, like, actual long serializations. And I think the same kind of went for Kishimoto as well. I don't think he had any long-running. I could be mistaken on that, but it's interesting to see someone who's had a 15-year-long series in Jump and look at something they did beforehand and kind of see the origins within the origins, so to speak. So, to that regard, I definitely think it's worth a good check out if you're interested.
Yeah, I mostly agree with that. And from all that I've gathered from Bleach fans who read this, seem to really enjoy it. And if they're into Kubo's, you know, kind of style, I can definitely see why. As someone who was a Bleach fan and stopped being a Bleach fan, I mostly just look at it and I see, okay, there's definitely problems with this. If Kubo had more experience, and if there were a few changes made, if some characters were a little bit more interesting, I think that this could have been really good. There are definitely, like, split opinions on this. Like, apparently, like, critical opinions of it are, it's okay. You know, C, very average. A couple people have been like, no, if this were in a series other than, you know, Jump in the late 90s, then this could have been a really long-running popular manga. And I'm like, I don't know about that. And Bleach fans seem to freaking love it. I think that it's okay, and it showed potential. And I definitely see how a guy went from doing this to doing a very long-running popular series. The potential is there. There just need to be changes made. So yeah, I pretty much agree with your final thoughts on that. Yeah, it's not especially good, but it is very interesting to read it with the context of what he went on to do.
There you go. You can pick up all the volumes, by the way, guys. They're all available digitally, and I think there actually still might be some physical volumes too if you want to grab them that way. And I imagine they probably don't still release them, but I'm sure you can find some secondhand.
Okay.
Boosh!
Gakadoom!
Blogist!
Blogist! We're going to start Blogist Week of Manga Recap of the Week.
Did you fall apart there, Nick?
A little bit. The Recap Bushing of Week of Manga Recap. Not with Bleach, but with Black Clover, which has, honestly, pretty goddamn badass-looking full-page color opening.
His eyes are very green.
Mm-hmm. I think that the sweat is a little... I think that his sweat is a little bit too thick and viscous-looking.
Nick, there's no reason for you to be intimidated by the size of his sweat. It doesn't say anything about you as a man if your sweat maybe isn't as big as his.
I'm just saying, it looks like he's angry because I've just gone into him finishing up something embarrassing.
I see what you're dirty.
Yeah. Page 72, Beyond Limits. Last time, Asta hit Veto with his sword and struck a decisive blow. But he's not done yet. No, we're not talking about last week's chapter. but Noelle declares, his magic is gone. I don't sense it anymore. So this time we really won. We really won, you guys.
He's definitely
done. We really won. He's definitely not getting up again. We really won this time.
She's like, I'll eat my hat if he gets back up again. If he gets back up, she's like, that's why I don't wear a hat, stupid.
Suckers.
Gotcha.
Asta pretty much collapses, but Finral and Vanessa catch him, give him, wrap him in a big old hug, and they're like, oh, you did a good job, kid. And Asta's like, guys, my arms are broken. This hurts. They're like, oh, yeah. Yeah. Congratulations get thrown around. They're like, you guys did a great job. I believe in you. And Noah's like, I'm here too. And they're like, oh yeah, that spell you threw around was really awesome. They're like, yeah, thanks. And he goes, congratulations. Yay. We won.
It's amusing that Finral's like, hey, and you're cute. And Noelle doesn't like chastise him or say anything weird to that. She's like, yes, praise me more.
I do love that bit. You know, Vanessa says, that new spell is incredible. She's like, yeah, praise me more. Finral's like, and you're cute, praise me more. The exact same reaction. So they're like, all right, good job. Okay, yeah, let's, you know, tie him up and wrap things up here. But we get a bit more flashback from Veto as he was approached by a kid leashed. And I do really like the symbolism of this, where he's holding this little tiny dead bird in his hands, and Kid Veto's really upset and says, I couldn't forgive them, they're tormenting this tiny creature. And Leech says, you know, look, we're just like this bird, we're not strong, but they're jealous of the fact that we can fly, so they hurt us. That's really cool. I like that. You know, it's not that we're strong, but we're blessed by mana, so people are jealous of us, and that's why they hurt us. And using that is apparently how he got his followers. And then, of course, eventually, village burned down by the Silvas. So, Veto, power starts surging around him. They're like, oh my god, you've got to be kidding me. And I was like, we were definitely victorious, though. He was definitely finished up.
I said definitively, he's not getting up from that.
And Veto thinks to himself, I'm taking you all with me. No, I'll blow this entire shrine away. Think Predator self-destruct sequence moment. He knows he's finished, so he's just going to blow everything up. Energy just starts swirling around him, giant black flames emerging around his body. And Asta's like, it's all right, we'll just send him flying again. Your arms are broken. What you gotta do, fly through the flame and not die? Good job, kid. Finral very nearly wimps out and says, what am I doing? I almost wimped out again. And everyone stands together and they're like, we're gonna do this! Yeah! And then Captain Yami shows up and he's like, nah, you stand back. I'll handle this. And he explains that he cut his way out of the spell that was keeping he and the High Priest imprisoned at their little watchtower. I guess it just took him a little while. I don't know. But, Masa's like, all right, yeah, let's fight together, Captain Yami. We're going to defeat this guy. And Yami's like, you know, you stop it. Look, come on. You guys have done your part. This time, I'm, you know, I'll take him on my own. I don't need you guys to help me. And he goes around and gives them all a pat on the head. Nice and endearing, and not in any way talking down to them. I just want to say, I really love the expression Noelle makes when he does it to her.
I can't tell if it's, like, indifference, or it's, like, expected, or if she's just so ecstatic she doesn't know what to do. So she's just, like, caught in, like a surge loop. She's just, like, so happy.
I'm not sure if that's... She almost looks annoyed to me. It's really hard to read her expression. I like that. Yeah, so he goes forward and he's like, all right, time to do this. And thanks to you guys, I managed to surpass my limits. Who would have thought that I would have learned a new spell now? I guess you can't get stronger no matter how old you are.
He learned a new spell, Nick, in his arbitrary book of spells.
Yes, it's really important that he learned a new spell.
I only point out because it's so confusing to me that they'll point out when they learn new spells. I mean, I guess it's actually better. Actually, you know what? Thinking on, I guess it's good they do this, because otherwise it would just be fairy tale, where characters just pull stronger techniques out of nowhere all the time.
And you don't, and then you're back why didn't you use that in X fight?
Yeah, you just always assume, like, where did you get this new armor, Urza, and why didn't you use it before, or whatever. So I guess it makes it, it's just confusing to me, because, like, the number of specific spells I have never seems to come up otherwise. They're never like, it's if only I had more spells.
It's not like Gash Bell, where you know that they have this many techniques.
Yeah, they only have three spells, and you have to utilize those the best way you can.
Mm-hmm. The only two that we know of, like, what they can do are Asta and Noelle, because they're rookie mages. And so we know definitely when they learn something new. So, but
we also got to see when, what's his name? Yuna? What's his name? He's on the cover page of the week. I've forgotten his name.
Go back three pages so that you can tell.
We saw him get a new spell when he got Sylph added to his book, so.
Right.
That seems to apply to it as well. It's kind of interesting because I feel like if they explained a lot more, they could have a kind of interesting system in their world. Something that would be like, oh, like, let's build an RPG for this already, you know?
Hmm. Yami says that his new spell cuts through dimensions and proceeds to cut Beto in half, it looks like. Because that right side looks a little bit higher than the left side of his face now that he's got that line going down it. So,
He's dead as shit.
He's probably dead now.
Well, I guess he did have that miracle magic, so maybe he could theoretically... I'm trying to think, have they killed villains?
I don't think so yet, no. It's possible, but...
What about that ice guy at the beginning? Did they kill him?
I don't remember.
I think Asta beat him, so he must not have killed him. That seemed like something he'd do.
But, it definitely seems like he's dead.
Yeah. He could possibly just, like, heal himself up, but he'd be too...
Regenerate somehow.
Yeah, but be too tired to continue, but... Yeah, he looks dead as shit.
Or...
people are saying he is dead. Well, I shouldn't say people. Thoughtalise is saying he's dead.
Or he could be like a starfish, and the two halves of his body grow extra halves, and then there's two Vetos running around.
Then Asta would need to... Gauss shows up, duplicates Asta, Vanessa uses her strings, Finral creates portals, and Asta beats both of them! They just find a new way to top themselves each chapter.
Alright. Let's move on to Bleach.
Well, wait, we didn't even talk about the chapter. Did you like it?
Oh! I thought it was fine. I don't know. I do think that there's, like... We won, but we haven't won yet, so now it's time for the captain to come along and finish things off. I think that that's a little bit... He goes around congratulating each of them. It's like, you guys did a good job. But it's like, yep, they didn't win, you know?
Well...
They won, but they didn't win. It feels like it takes away from it a little bit.
I did really like
Beto's flashback, but other than that, all the entire rest of it, I just kind of go, eh.
I can totally see your point. I think what I'm kind of looking at right now, because they made a big deal about how strong these three were, how they were technically stronger than Leashed, how they're on the level of a Magic Knight captain. So having Veto continually kind of get up and overcome, even Asta beating him a couple times, does show this guy to be a threat, and having it be that even though they used all this teamwork, even though they, you know, so many people and so many members of the Black Bulls were concentrated in an effort to beat this guy, they still couldn't completely defeat him. They managed to get past his magic, but he was essentially going to suicide and take everyone out with him, it seemed to be the case. But then Yami steps in and changes that. I think that does kind of firmly establish that this dude was on a level that Yami was more apt to take down, and that they could potentially in the future make sure the other two members of the Third Eyes, or whatever they call themselves, are equally as intimidating or equally have that same kind of prestige to them. So I think to that regard I can look at it and like it. The only thing that's just sort of weird is this is coming essentially after that long fight with Leashed that also had like six non-endings in a row. So it's like, I hope this is just kind of building these guys up with the right credibility and not just an indicative sign of Tabata really likes having fights that go on after like seven false finishes.
Cena versus Orton. Yeah, come on.
You just, if you haven't done your finisher six times, it's not even a match.
Yeah. You gotta do it off of a ladder through a table in order to finish him off.
I was like, it's not actually your finisher until you do it off the top rope.
Mm-hmm. Now, as we move on to Bleach, 684 of the Blade. Last time, Ichigo managed to capitalize on Aizen using Kyoka Suigetsu to distract Yubak in order to attack him from behind with Getsuka Tensho, cutting his body in half. And this chapter opens up with Yubak completing his turn around to look at Ichigo, and then his physical body just kind of splats. It devolves into the dark with eyes, and he doesn't seem to have solid form anymore. So, Aizen steps up, and he goes, "Not bad. Good job reacting to my Kyoka, so he gets to. Oh, that's gone. Anyway." He's not even acting dizzy.
It's like, huh, where did that come from?
Hey, look, I can draw with my stump, guys.
I guess I don't need to go on that diet anymore.
My BMI is much lower now. So, Ichigo explains, "Well, yeah, I felt something strange making my way here. It was the same feeling I got when you cast Kyoka Suigetsu on everybody." And Aizen says, "Yes, I released it before you all arrived here, and was convinced I could interfere with his vision of the future of like Kyoka Suigetsu, and also that his illusions would not work on you. I didn't think keeping Kyoka Suigetsu's release in from you would come in handy like this." We get it.
Can you explain to me what exactly he's trying to say? Well, so, Ichigo... Or Aizen made himself appear like he was Ichigo so that Yubak went and attacked him. So Yubak presumably was under the effects of a Shikai.
Yes.
Ichigo is immune to the effects of the Shikai?
He has been forever because... Okay.
He's never seen it released.
That's right. Aizen, when his ability was first revealed, he explained that, you know, every time that... They actually, like, said that there was some sort of ceremony where he would demonstrate his abilities for, like, all the Soul Reapers. You know, he would show off, like, you know, this is my release Shikai, this is what I can do with it. And he revealed it to literally everyone in Soul Society. So, in order to actually be under its effects, you have to see it being released. Because Ichigo was around after that all happened, Aizen never got the chance to do that, and he never bothered to actually do it, because Hyogyoku, basically. Yeah. So, Ichigo is explaining, "I felt the same thing as I felt back when you fought with everyone, you know." Which, I guess, okay. But they're basically going through to a long explanation just to say, "I use my Kyoka Suigetsu. It doesn't work on you." Ichigo's like, "I know, and I felt it, but I didn't see anything because I'm not affected by it."
I guess I'm still just confused as to how Ichigo hasn't seen it, but Yubak saw it.
I'm not sure either.
Because was there a shot? Like, he broke the chair. We didn't see him do the release, but then it's like that fucking genjutsu loophole where it's but I hid from you the perception that I never released it, but in fact I did, and immediately covered it up with the illusion. Like, that sort of weirdness.
Well, remember back when the arc began, and there was the first invasion of Soul Society, Yubak went down into Aizen's prison to see if he could convince him to join his side, and
that released it there.
Well, no. Aizen used his ability at that point in order to trick him, in order to make him think that less time had passed than really had. He altered his perception of the time that had passed. So regardless of where he actually had done it,
assumed it was
Aizen. Maybe it's because he's the Almighty and he sees all. So because he's seen everything happen, he has also seen Aizen's Shikai be released.
That's a good answer. My thought process was that whole thing where he's like, so much time's passed, was him being like, "Wow, Aizen, you're such a great conversationist. I just, the time just flew and I never even realized it." One moment we're exchanging pleasantries, and the next moment we're talking about our favorite movies of the year for hours.
Oh, boy. Suddenly, darkness surges around them. The darkness that had appeared around Yubak's body is spread out all across the floor beneath them. There's eyes everywhere. And Yubak starts speaking to them. And He says, "You have undone Kyokusui Getsu's effect. Was it overconfidence or lack of power? Did you think you could kill me with something like that?" And
we need to, like,
when were you ever under the perception that you could kill me?
That's the other thing. There's always the joke of, like, the Bleach arm count. There needs to be another one of, when did you think, or did you think, such and such explanation, that Bleach sentence structure that's just so intrinsic to Kubo.
I'm going through and rereading Bleach in order to prepare for the trivia contest, so maybe I'll make a count of it. Essentially starts to regenerate from the darkness in eyes. His physical shape appears first, and you see his mouth form through it. It's actually a really cool effect. Like, you know, nothing on his body actually has definition except for his mocking, the mocking expression his mouth makes. Very Cheshire Cat-like. But he says, "My power alters the future! I can even rewrite the future in which I die!" Which is bullshit.
I love this. It sucks. I'll mention 100 times.
8-year-olds fighting. No, you didn't really kill Ichigo. You stabbed me. See, because I used my power to alter your perception. But you didn't really kill me. See, because I used my alteration ability to alter the future in which I die. So you can't kill me. You shoot me and the bullet bounces off.
See, I'll mention a million times how I think it's very tragic Bleach is getting his ending in this way and how it's very unsatisfying. But I can't help but love that we've spent so much time with Aizen, and there was all that, like, that mysterious build-up about the Fullbringers. And essentially, both of them, I guess the Fullbringer one kind of had a payoff, but Aizen essentially came back to be ineffectual and lose. Like, that's what happened. Because this didn't really do anything. Like,
well, yeah,
we're about to find out what...
Aizen's one of the casualties of the sudden conclusion, I think.
There had to have been more plan for this guy. We've never even really seen or understood what his Bankai is. I had to assume that was going to be...
He's never used his Bankai before. We've never seen that, and we've never seen Ukitake's Bankai, but he seems to be dead.
Oh my god! I forget about shit that's supposed to be a plot point. What the fuck ever happened with the Soul King?
Where's Kira?
There's so much stuff that's not gonna get answered.
We've never seen Hirako's Bankai. There's a lot of stuff that people are upset about. There are elements of, like, you know, what was the first 1,000-year blood war like, that kind of stuff that's never going to be followed up on because there's just not enough time for it. Is Yashiro actually Zaraki just Kenpachi's Zanpakuto spirit? Has she been this whole time? Which brings up a whole multitude of other questions, such as, well, he seems to get along with her really well. Why didn't he get along with his sword at all?
There's still 2 more chapters left. All these questions. I hope that it's like the next chapter is just like 6 characters stand in a line. They're like, "What does your Bankai do? It does this. What does your Bankai do? It does this. What does this? Rose, I thought you were dead. No, I'm not, actually. Here's what my Bankai does." And the last...
Unohana, you came back!
Yeah, and you're not... You actually were dead, but you did come back. And the last shot is someone looking in a door, and they're like, "How, Bell? How long have you been in there?" Credits. Kubo says, "Thank you for reading Bleach."
Oh, boy. Ichigo tries to attack Yubak. Yubak says, "Don't bother!" Hence, I guess it goes flying out of Ichigo's hand, all shattered again. It lands in the ground. Ichigo goes running towards it. The darkness intercepts him. Darkness swirls everywhere, surrounding everything. It starts to drown Ichigo in it, and he says, "It's over! The living world! The Soul Society! It will all lose shape and become one when faced with my power!" As the super awesome arrow shoots into Yubak, he looks around and is like, "What is this? And why did I not see it coming with my all-seeing power and all these eyes literally looking everywhere?"
Well, maybe he took it because he's like fucking a cocky dickhead.
I don't know.
Or maybe he didn't see it because of Aizen's power. Maybe Aizen wasn't completely worthless after all, and they'll address that next week. And they'll be like, he didn't dodge it because he didn't realize it was there thanks to Aizen's power. And Aizen's power wasn't... Aizen's involvement wasn't literally to be like, I think we got him. He just go, oh, no, we didn't. Ugh.
So, we get this narration as the effects of the Silver Arrow take a hold of Yubak, which says, Sokin once told me, the silver that appears from Auswallen is known as the Silver of Stillness. By mixing it with the blood of the one who has activated Auswallen, all of that person's abilities, for a brief moment, will cease to exist.
So,
why did Ishida have to shoot this arrow?
So, if you shot Grimmy with this, would he just fall into like a... like he would just turn into the brain in the jar, crash into the ground, crack and die, essentially?
Well, that...
would he cease to exist because he no longer has the power to imagine himself not as a brain in a jar?
I don't know. So, Yubak's powers are momentarily completely disrupted. Ichigo grabs his sword. Yubak says, so what? So what if you halted my power for a moment? His power surges up around him again. And she is like, no, he's not going to make it in time. And Ichigo swings Tenta Zangetsu and Yubak. Yubak goes to block it with his hand. Suddenly, Tenta Zangetsu shatters, revealing regular Zangetsu. And in a big two-page spread with no background, Ichigo...
You have so limited like, space left, Kubo. Why?
It's... For as huge a moment as this is the end of the final battle. That two-page spread should look so much cooler than it actually does. It's a good start. It's a cool pose. Ichigo's got all his battle scars. His Haori's all cut up. There's the, you know, remnants of Tenta Zangetsu shattering around it. But that's it. There's, like, no power surging around him. It's a completely blank white background. It should look so much cooler than it actually does. So... Yubak thinks in his final moments, Zangetsu, of course. So what I saw that time, remembers the dream that he had where Ichigo cut through him with Zangetsu, was the future seen with my own eyes. I thought it was a dream you made me see, Hashbolt. And then he's cut in half, and the chapter ends. All right.
Should have grown a goatee.
So. What this means, I guess, I'm 90% sure of this, is that Yubak thought that Ichigo could not actually stop him because he had already broken Tensei Zangetsu. He had already destroyed it. So Ichigo just dispelled his Bankai in order to hit him with Zangetsu. Which I'm not sure exactly why that works, but it worked, whatever, he killed him. My second point is, what the fuck was the point of Ichigo getting a new fucking Bankai?
It didn't do anything.
It did literally nothing.
Like, I guess it had the...
literally no... Literally. There was... Remember how long Ichigo and company were up with the Zero Squad so that he could do all of his training to craft a new Zangetsu? He hits him with the same old sword.
It was,
Literally, years. Pointless. Ichigo has done nothing this arc. He has not grown as a character in terms of power, because he hits him with the same old thing. It is...
It wasn't by his own actions this even came about.
Yeah. This is...
Not even in any step of the process was it by his own actions. Shibishima repaired his sword, Aizen helped him land the first blow, and Uryu set up the final attack.
Even as someone who doesn't like Bleach, hasn't liked Bleach for the better part of half a decade, has been so pissed off by so many things, even I think that this is ridiculously disappointing. There was... For all the build-up that Yubak got, he was basically beaten by something that Ichigo got in, like, chapter 30 or somewhere around there.
There's just no emotion in any of this. Like, Ichigo doesn't have a single thing to say to Yuubaki in all this.
No.
He says nothing. He just attacks him with his sword. And it's not even like there's this... I mean, there probably is, but it doesn't really feel like there's much of a symbolic thing in defeating him with his original sword. Like, maybe if this entire arc had been about Ichigo forgetting his roots, or accepting who he was and not what he's become over time as this amalgam of everything in the series, maybe then it would have this kind of special meaning. But as it is here, it's just like, underneath my new sword was my old sword!
Maybe there is something coming. Maybe there was something originally planned. Regardless of all that, though, this sucks. And I can't imagine what your feeling must be like if you are still a fan of Bleach at this point. I can't imagine any of you being happy with this. This has got to suck for all of you. This is not good. It's really not good. It's not even so bad it's amazing. It's just... that's it. That's really it. In terms of this whole fight, that's it. That's
this whole arc. This is what this all amounted to? 4 years?
What?
No development for Ryu in this entire process.
Well, at least Ishida gets to do something in the end.
He for does. All that we it's talk- a hollow action, but he does get to do something.
At least, there is definitely a symbolic gesture of, you know, the arrow that killed my mother, I get to finally strike out and use that in order to defeat the person who is responsible for her death and the deaths of so many of my people. He gets to have that resolution. Ichigo swings his sword.
Ta-da.
Remember that whole thing about, you know, the importance of crafting the new sword, of acknowledging his Quincy powers, realizing that, you know, his hollow powers and Zangetsu and his Soul Reaper powers were what he got from his father, and his Quincy powers were what he got from his mother, and he combined them together in order to take on Yuubaki and stand against his power. Now it's just, I got my old Soul Reaper sword. Blech. That's it. It sucks. And that's all I have to say about that.
Yeah, we have 2 more weeks left, and then Bleach is over. 2 more chapters left, I should say. Although, this may not be the news you want to hear, Nick. There's mm-hmm. supposedly going to be a special announcement regarding Bleach in, I think it's the 24th. The 24th, the week of the 24th. But that issue is supposed to be an announcement.
We'll so see.
Perhaps there's something. It could be completely unrelated to the manga. It might be like, hey, the anime is coming back. Or, hey, there's going to be a new musical. Hey, there's going to be a new data book. It could be anything like that. But, I don't know. I earnestly feel like I cannot believe Bleach will be over until its final chapter is run and 6 months have passed in the magazine. Without and Kubo, a single chapter of Bleach coming up. Because nothing would be more Kubo than a month from now.
Oh, you thought Bleach had
687. So you thought it was done?
Don't call it a comeback.
Well, his would be like, come back and then don't call it or something like that. It's fucked up English.
Oh, God. It sucks. Let's move on to Fairy Tail.
Which definitely didn't suck. Fairy Tail chapter 496 forward. It looks like he smells a fart. Oh, it's such a weird cover. I don't quite understand why. Why am I forgetting this dude's name?
It's Gildarts.
Gildarts. There we go. Why Gildarts looks like he's smelling a fart, like ugh. Or like he's just looking at something that offends him, like ugh. I can't believe. You're gonna watch Batman versus Superman? Why don't I just throw 3 hours of my life away? So, if you remember, last time the two forces were engaging, fighting each other, Gildart showed up and kind of blocked God Serena from wrecking all of them. And I'm going to kind of go fast through this one, because there's really not a lot to talk about. Just a lot of stupid, goofy interactions with one another. Gildard's basically notes, like, there's no living magic in God Serena. He's not even really the same person he was. And he says how disappointed he is, because he thinks he'd be much more interesting as an opponent were he still alive and had all of his magic. I guess implying that...
I like people, that sentiment.
I like that. But it's, I guess it also implies that when you're brought back, you come back at a fraction of your power. Ageo starts throwing up a sandstorm.
Desert.
So Elfman leaps into the fray saying, "Let me blaze a man's path forward." Turns into a special sand beast that I guess is immune to sand. Then immediately gets sucked into a hole that fucking Lasana has to pull him out of. It is embarrassing. It's like, what the fuck? You couldn't give Elfman 2 pages of looking cool before he just looks embarrassed. Alright, Nick. Some hypothetical situation has spurred this on. You have to live the life of either Elfman or Chad. Which one do you pick? Because I'm not really sure which one's the
best. At least Chad's cool.
Yeah, like, I feel like both of them are such a, like, shitty situation of just constantly being the joke of everything. Jacob Lassim, I think was his name, is about to fight Mira Jane until he notices how big her boobs are. Wall was going up against Mirvana. I don't know why, I'm forgetting. Minerva and Rogue. I'm like having a stroke.
I love this moment where they're like, "You're here!" And they're like, "How'd you get here?" "Well, this young lady showed us the way." She's like, "Hello." And I'm like, "Who are you?"
Yeah, I stopped. I was like, "Who is..." Oh, right, that dead person who came back. I forgot, because you've done nothing. They just don't have...
I don't even know who she is. Like, I don't know. I just know, like, your tits are fucking huge. They go out past her arms. It was like, "Who are you?" There's even a helpful little bit that says that she's a member of Fairy Tail. Like, she is?
Yeah, she finished guiding Gajeel here, and then, I guess she's just hanging around now. There's also a joke about what's-her-name shaking her butt. This chapter blows. I'm sorry, there's just so much non-interesting dialogue going on here that I'm just jumping over because I don't care about it.
There's a running thing that one... kid who looks up and dresses as Natsu is scared, but everyone kicks all the nameless soldiers' asses, and then they're like, "Now let's march forward," and he's like, "Yeah!" And he falls behind them, because, let me tell you something. Until that 25th most important member of the guild gets the courage to fight on, then I had no hope.
Some people are saying that's not the character guided Gajeel. Then who the fuck is she?
The one who guided Gajeel was Zara, right?
Isn't that Zara?
No.
Then who the fuck is she?
I don't know.
See, I'm gonna get on a tangent here about this little kid thing. Even though we're not done the chapter, I need to get it out of the way. This is just a dry non-issue, because it's not like we're imposed by these villains anymore. Like, if this were done last week, before the two sides started to clash, and it's just him looking at the sheer forces they're up against and finding himself intimidated by that and being daunted by just how enormous they are, I can understand it. This is after they've already started fighting back, and had a heroic, like, interference from Gildard's. This isn't the point that this character should start freaking out. If anything, this should be where he's finding himself most encouraged. Now, granted, he does through the course of this chapter, but it's just a wrong place and time for this sort of thing to take place. Plus, it doesn't really matter much, because I don't really care about this character.
Like, yeah.
It's just this sense of being like, Fairy Tail's got all of their encouragement and power behind themselves, and they're going to charge with friendship into the fray! And it's like, yay! They were doing it already, but I guess they're doing it even harder now, with smiles on their face in this devastating final war for the fate of the universe. Credits. And that's basically where it ends. We see Zarif's right-hand secretary man dude.
Her name is Kinana, I think.
Wasn't that a Rihanna song? Like... Kinana, what's the name? Kinana, what's the name? Yeah, it's a Rihanna song. She doesn't look like Rihanna, though.
No, she doesn't.
I hope that means there's not a Chris Brown mage around here anywhere. I bet he would have fist magic.
Okay.
I really don't have anything nice to say about this chapter, unfortunately.
No, it's just...
It's too much of that fairy tale. Forward,
then little shitty kid is just like, yeah, I'm going to fight too. And he's like, do you even have magic? I don't care. Let's name the various members of Fairy Tale more important than this kid. Natsu, Gray, Happy, Carla, Wendy, Urza, Lucy, Elfman, Mira Jane, Lisanna, Biska, the sniper girl, Loke, Makarov, Gildarts,
Jet, Drowy, Kana,
Levy,
Laxus, Evergreen, Bixlow.
There's so many! Who cares?
And then the unending amount of characters from other guilds who are more important than you.
Oh my god.
Yeah, this was just sort of a waste of a chapter. I don't quite understand why we did it.
I agree. Let's move on to Food Wars. Shokugeki no Soma, the one where they make potato noodles.
Back just a sec.
Yeah, right. It is chapter 177. If this fucking page will load. Come on. Come on, Shonen Jump. Oh, come on, Shonen Jump. You know you want to load. There you go. The Rise of a Jeanne d'Arc. Which I guess is their way of saying Joan of Arc, whatever. So, yes, everyone is cooking, even though they've got no noodles. People around them are freaking out. The instructor for the course says, they must be bluffing! They don't have anything that could possibly pass without any noodles. But he gets a call that says that all of the different people in all the different rooms are actually making their own rooms. And so Soma pauses to address Endo and says, well, you know, if you really wanted to fail all of us, you shouldn't have left piles of these potatoes lying around. And he says, yep, we're all making Gosetsu Udon. Long explanation, basically, you make noodles from, make udon noodles from potato. Gosetsu Udon noodles are 95% starch. Good enough for me. There's an explanation for what they do in order to actually make the batter for them. They mold them together, then of course they just, you know, spin them into noodles. But Endo is still thinking, well, you know, there aren't any topping ingredients here. The other students had to go to the metropolitan downtown district to bring back toppings worthy of a gourmet noodle dish. So just because they have the noodles, that doesn't mean they're going to pass! We get a flashback, though, to when Arida was instructing everyone about the myriad of uses of the potato, the magical, wonderful ingredient, the most versatile of all of the roots, the potato. The potato is so good.
Are we talking about how sweet potatoes are, Nick?
Potatoes are awesome, okay? I didn't need a chapter dedicated to how potatoes are, good potatoes are, because I already know potatoes are awesome, all right?
It's kind of interesting. I mean, like, wasn't that also the big thing in the first chapter? When Soma had to make a meat dish without any meat, he wrapped bacon around potatoes and let the potatoes kind of soak into juice. It gave it the...
Because potatoes are awesome!
Yeah. I feel like 90% of their challengers could be like, I'm really fucking... There's like one out there in Totsuki...
Why is there not a potato guy?
Like, just one Irish potato motherfucker who's just like, Irish bacon, Medora! I made Irish potato seafood, and it's amazing, because potatoes can be anything! Till one time they're like... No potatoes in this dish. She's like, you're going to fuck me over there, Totsuki Institute. I'll take a shillelagh to your knee.
They're going to be graduating to second year soon, so maybe one of the first year students introduced will specialize in potatoes.
Oh, it'll be like that kid in Ice Shield 21 that nobody liked because he all of a sudden became the huge, like, the third biggest member of the team despite no one liking him.
Chubo, yeah.
The dude who's like, I'm the second best member of your line now, and like, me as the Jumanji fan is in the background like, what? He didn't get to make first team, but this kid did.
Oh my god. Fuck that kid.
He's like the cousin Oliver of
Original character, do not steal. No, there's a new member of the Table of Devil Bats.
He just showed up.
He can send the best lineman in the country flying because of his Delta Dynamite technique. Ignore the fact that he's fucking 5 foot nothing.
And the other dude's like 6 foot 12. Why don't you say 7 feet? He wants to be known as 6 foot 12.
Oh, God. Yeah, I'm terrified of him. Yeah, so everyone has made all of these different potato noodle dishes. Endo, of course, is blown away by them. He has to pass them because they're so good. I do like that there is a bit where Soma's, you know, launching into his smug rant. It's like, you see, this dish, you know, and he's like, this dish uses all the facets of the Irish cobbler potato, accenting its starch. She just completely cuts him off. This thing, over the explanation. And so it's like, oh. But yeah, they pass. Everyone passes. All the resistors pass. Yay! Endo actually confronts Erina over it as people are gathering around her to celebrate. And he says, you guys all only survived because of Miss Erina's mercy. Without a magnanimous... That is a wonderful word. Magnanimous. Without a magnanimous Nakiri there to hold your filthy hands, you wouldn't have... And Erina cuts him off and says, all I did was teach them the special properties a potato holds. How to use those potatoes and the inspiration to make Gosetsu Udon noodles was entirely theirs. Remember this well, sir. These chefs are much too high of caliber to fail because of the likes of you. And there's this page and a half spread of Erina standing at the front of the entire group of all the resistors. Which I do really like, because we don't really get group shots like this in Soma.
There's not many group efforts in Soma, because the biggest moments are Shokugeki's, which are usually solo affairs.
So I really like having the group shot of everyone gathered together and the various expressions they're all making and stuff.
I don't know why. I think it's just because her eyes are always kind of weird and it's seen from the profile. Alice is terrifying me.
She does look pretty creepy in that.
It's like she's like, I just saw you doing the worst thing ever and I'm about to blackmail the shit out of you. Or, I'm just gonna fucking cut your dick off and sell it. I'm like, why? She's like, I don't know. Like, no.
Oh, God. So Endo is thinking to himself, no, this isn't what was supposed to happen. This level of leadership, it's almost as if Jeanne d'Arc herself was reincarnated. And he imagines, like, Erina in a fucking suit of armor leading a nation. It's such a cool picture, honestly.
I do like this particular kind of interpretation of her, too. Like, building up this idea that it's Erina, not Soma right now,
who's the leader.
She's the face of the resistance.
Yeah. I was saying for quite a while, I was like, oh, I'm looking forward to Erina doing stuff. And even though Erina is not taking direct action at this point, even just, you know, her taking this role of leadership and having this amount of prominence in the series, I really do like it. And that is a really cool picture, seriously. So everyone passes, and but meanwhile, lurking around the corner, some Secret Service agent-looking motherfucker is on the phone. Resistance members have passed. Yes, I'll send for them immediately.
My glasses have two bridges. That makes them twice as effective.
Attention, chefs!
I gotta be honest, though. I haven't been crazy on Food Wars in a little bit.
Nothing's really gotten...
pretty slow for a while.
Well, I mean, I'm still remaining optimistic because this is only part two of six of this thing. They're, you know, slowly building. They don't have much of a challenge to overcome yet. They've only been overcoming the most basic kind of sabotage so far. Oh, we didn't give you good ingredients. Oh, we barely gave you any ingredients. So I think that as we could move forward, you know, considering that you start off with, you have to make a noodle dish without noodles, I think that we're going to see them have to do some pretty crazy shit by the time that they actually get to the end of these exams.
I hope the next time they're like, you have to make steak tartare, and we're breaking your hands. What? Bam, bam. Ah, why? They're like, you are going to pass. If you were just going to assault us, why didn't you just do it and get it over with? I wanted to see you flumble around trying to make steak tartare with broken hands.
They're like... All right, in order to even approach the ingredients table, you have to press this plunger and hope that it doesn't explode the giant Bowser balloon in front of you.
Jackass, all of them make them explode. All right.
We failed the entire class!
You can have steak tartare. The steak's over there. You just have to be very careful of the very angry bear in front of the steak cabinet. Which, just, the other ones don't have the bear. Only yours has the bear, but just, you know, slip on
the
by.
Bear has been getting, the bear gets larger and larger the more students approach. So it starts off as, like, an embryo, and the last ones that were in there had to just deal with a tiny cub. This one, you have to deal with a black bear. You know, it's 6 feet tall. The last of you is going to have to deal with the grizzly, so... Okay. Yeah, Food Wars, it was... I do like just having those visuals, but I do agree that, like, the challenges they've overcome, really not especially noteworthy yet. So, I want more. My Hero Academia is next. So, yeah, let's talk about that. The training took Deku to seek out what do they call it? The fucking equipment
R&D,
yeah. In order to get something to hopefully brace himself. But he ended up having Hatsume, the gadget girl who was introduced in the tournament arc, to fall on him, which ended the chapter with boobs!
Boobs.
I like the little character profile we get for Tokoyami.
Tokoyami's choker. Cool.
In order to keep Dark Shadow going strong, Tokoyami dons a shade-providing cape as part of his costume. Very cool!
I have to assume this was written by him, and he just had to put very cool, not lame, in a lot of things.
Yeah. But I also
carries a sword around with him. Very cool, not lame!
I do ever like the little note about his beak. Whenever he eats with chopsticks, he's got to put them in through the side because he can't get them in his mouth. It's like, oh, that's a detail that I hadn't really thought of. Yeah. Anyway, everyone's recovered from the explosion that went off. Hatsume greets everyone. She's like, ah, what were your names again? he's like, anyway, gotta go get back to work. But Deku's like, wait a minute, I want to actually talk to Power Loader Sensei about revising my costume. She's like, oh, really? He just gets right in his face. Hatsume really steals the show in this chapter, just all over the goddamn place. Just, girl drinks too much caffeine, I think. You know, Power Loader is being all professional and is like, oh yeah, you know, I was given the heads up by Eraserhead saying that some kids might want costume accommodations. So yeah, let's look over some stuff. Let's think about what we want to do. There's a process that, you know, we could get some stuff done within a few days. And Deku says, yeah, you know, this is what I want to do. I want to actually reduce the stress of the ligaments in my arms. And Parallel starts, you know, talking about, I was like, yeah, that won't be a problem. We'll get stuff done in a jiffy. And then all of a sudden, Hatsume just kind of grabs onto him. It's hard to tell exactly what she's doing.
She's just feeling on him, but I think
feeling his muscles. Yeah.
Yeah, she's trying to get a gauge. Essentially like how a tailor would kind of fit a clothes to a person. She's just trying to get a feel for his physique.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, but she was also making notes like, oh, you know, he's more ripped than he looks. Okay, yeah, this should work. And she puts him in this fucking power suit. this thing that makes him look like 3 feet taller. And she's like, okay, so what happens is it senses when your muscles contract and aids in your movement. It is my 49th creation. Next, like, it, you know, turns to look at her. Well, you know, I just wanted something to support my arms. Wait, why is it still turning? Oh, I guess that... Ah! It just turns him completely around. Oops, sorry, it's a little bit buggy still, sorry. Ida goes over to Power Loader and says, yeah, I want to strengthen the radiators of my legs if it's possible. What if you try using them on your arms? These giant jets on his arms. Oh my god. Just turns on the booster without Ida's permission. He jets up into the ceiling and bangs his head against it. And he says, well, my quirk is in my legs. Yeah, but I was thinking, if you need to rest your legs, then what if you try running with your arms instead? Doesn't make any fucking sense.
Like, okay. You're insane. Mm.
Oh, God. So Parallel apologizes on Hatsume's behalf and says, you know, yeah, her ego knows no bounds. It's like a sickness. And Ida's like, we know. Oh, God.
You don't normally get that sort of emotion out of Ida.
Yeah. And Uraraka, of course, is really pissed off from all that Hatsume's been doing. But Parallel says, well, look, despite that attitude, you're going to have to, you know, learn to get along with her, because when you turn pro, she is going to be your support. You know, look at all this. You see all that junk over there? Those are all the different support items that Hatsume has been creating since school started. She keeps coming in during weekends. She comes in during vacation. She's always working at something new. She's got so much enthusiasm for this. And, you know, she's got all these failed experiments, but common sense is the collection of procedures acquired by age 18. It's a quote from Einstein. She doesn't fear failure. Every one of her ideas gets put to the test. The best innovators out there are unconstrained by convention. And Deku gets a huge burst of inspiration from this, remembering, you know, All Might's words to him, you know, you're still trying to emulate me. But then also remembers Hatsune saying, oh, well, if you need to rest your legs, try using your arms and stuff. And so he's like, I've got it! And so he goes, he says to Ida, can you, you know, try teaching me some of your moves? You know, so they kind of abandon the costume thing, and they talk about some stuff. And I do like that it ends on the note of Uraraka being like, oh, yeah, I was thinking about trying to get something that would, you know, help keep me from getting motion sick whenever I use my powers on myself. And Hatsune's like, use this!
I have another thing for you, too!
It looks like she's holding a bundle of dynamite, too. I'm not exactly what the hell that thing is under her arm. But we get a montage.
Dangerous.
Yeah, we get a montage. We see Todoroki using both his fire and ice powers at the same time. We see Kaminari and Kirishima approaching Hatsume about something. Shoji using his powers to, like, extend his arm. Mineta using a bunch of gloves at once on, like, a chain. Uraraka levitating rocks.
I couldn't tell what,
Jiro's, like, attaching something to her wrist. I'm not sure exactly what that is either. Maybe she got some equipment to help her out, too.
I thought she was, like, just inspecting her fingernails.
I think that it might be, like, the strap on her wrist that she's doing something to. Maybe she's got something to, like, plug herself into. I don't know.
Her thing's hearing, essentially, right?
She can also cause vibrations with her jack strands. So, I don't know. Several days later, we get Toshinori checking in on the training, and Aizawa says, yeah, they're doing pretty well. Deku now does have a modification to his costume with supporters on it to reduce stress on his arms. And Mineta, you know, brings up, why don't you, you know, just kind of go for, like, a total makeover? You know, you've got this really plain-looking costume, you know, instead of just making a small modification. And Deku thinks, I don't want to change the basic design, as he remembers the costume that his mom designed for him. Aww!
That's very sweet. Nice moment.
And we get to see some of the finalized techniques that some people have. Tokoyami now has Dark Shadow cover his whole body. By cloaking myself with Dark Shadow, I compensate for my physical weakness and close combat vulnerability. I call it Abyssal Black Body! And the teacher's like, well, that's kind of a mouthful, isn't it? Your ultimate move should be kind of easier to say out loud.
Which is horseshit. Horseshit. Because if the next chapter doesn't begin with Midnight walking up to Deku and is like, yeah, did you hear that Abyssal Black Body was too long? Yeah, one for all full counting shoot style is definitely not going to cut it either.
Bakugo now focuses his explosion on a fixed point, so he, like, shoots an explosion from, I guess...
He basically focuses it through his, like, enclosed hand, so it comes out in a focused burst, which I actually think is a very creative way to kind of make that, like, evolve that power.
He refers to it as his armor-piercing shot.
Yeah, it's a very good use, because I didn't quite get what Todoroki's thing is. I thought the darkness was always on him. I guess this is just a, like, active version.
Tokoyami uses his shadow to accomplish a variety of different things, but the shadow tends to just operate on its own. So this is like, I'm going to use it to physically enhance myself.
Got it.
So I can punch criminals in the face. But Bakugo's practicing causes the rock that he was shooting at to fall off a cliff, and it's about to hit Toshinori. And so Bakugo shouts out a warning. Aizawa gets ready to take action, but suddenly Deku jumps into the air, swing his leg around, and he kicks the rock into oblivion. And as he's, you know, descending through the air, even before actually the attack connects, Toshinori realizes that, yeah, Deku has already found his own way. He just notices the difference in movement and sees that he's learned. And, yeah, Deku kicks the rock, and he thinks to himself, All Might's ultimate moves are all about his fists. Without even thinking about it, I subconsciously decide that that's how I'd have to use One For All, too. It's so simple. So simple that I never even realized. If I'm worried about my arms, I'll focus on my legs instead. One For All, full cowling, shoot style. So he's Sanji now.
I like the way it's all drawn here. I guess it's because we've seen generally punches before, but there was something about Horikoshi Sensei's art of a kick that just feels so impactful with the way he draws
the way
it, that elongated curve.
The leg is drawn to be as big as the rest of his body. It looks really cool.
Yeah. It's actually pretty cool. And I think this is an interesting thing to see. I'm really kind of curious to see how they kind of evolve this from here.
And I could be wrong, but I think that they also imply that his... I think that he's modified the legs of his costume,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, there's definitely actually kind of like, I don't know if necessarily armor, but some kind of padding, basically from, like, his thighs down.
Let me see if I can actually get a good shot of him for that. I think he had that, he might have had that before. It's probably just a matter of, like, the emphasis that his legs are getting in this pic and in that panel.
Yeah.
But yeah. Cool little chapter. Yeah. I look forward to seeing how everyone has evolved, not just Deku.
Indeed.
Let's move on to One Piece, chapter 834, My Dream. Last time, Sanji and his father, Judge, had a fight, and Judge won through dirty tactics, and has clamped these restraining devices on Sanji's wrists so that if he attempts to escape without going through with the marriage, then his hands will be blown off, and so he'll lose his means of preparing food for people. We get a bit of Sanji trying to struggle to get them off, and he's warned by his family, look, if you try and pry them loose, then they're going to explode, so you gotta stop. The only way to take them off is with the key. And Big Mom has one of them. So Sanji is just incredibly disgusted and distraught over this. He's shouting out his frustration before we cut away.
Actually, the thing that I like the most about this is the two small flashback panels that show Zeff hitting Sanji and saying, look what you've done to your hands. Are these hands attached just so that you can fight with them? Mm-hmm. And kind of showing some of the relationship that they had. I think a little bit of the reason I didn't get so invested last week is because a lot of it was like, here's a bunch of characters you've never really met before that Sanji has a relationship with. Whereas here, it's like, oh, this touches back to a relationship that we've seen, like, mm-hmm. a long foundation of. So it's kind of nice seeing Sanji's anguish coming back to how much he prides his hands as a chef and how that's kind of the gift that Zeff gave him.
Mm. So, we go to the Sweet City, where Brook and Pedro are still hanging out. I love Brook's disguise, the, like, turban, like, wrapped all around his head. You can still tell you're a skull, dude.
Well, he needs to have the turban, I guess, because how else would you hide the afro? You can't even put a hat on.
There are people gossiping about the news that has recently broken about Jinbei's attempt to leave Big Mom, but apparently when he heard the price, he withdrew his request. Some people are like, oh, what a wimp. Ah, good grief. I'm so disappointing. He's a traitor and a coward. So Brook is, you know, taking in this information and saying, oh, so he's part of Big Mom's operation. That's why Fishman Island is under her protection. But they also observe the fact that, oh man, this guy's a former warlord of the sea and he's working for Big Mom. That's how much power she has. Brook is just thinking to himself, yeah, well, this doesn't really sound like Jinbei, though. It doesn't sound like something that he would do, that he would just suddenly, you know, cow so easily into this. Why isn't he, you know, just withdrawing from the crew so that he can join with us? What's going on? Pedro then spots Chris.
Baron Tamago. Can I do it?
Let's just do this conversation, fucking. I'll be putting and the dressmaker, and you'd be married to him.
Well, he doesn't say anything here.
No. Oh, okay, where does he start to talk?
He says, I think
he says that they've got to choose their dress, so let's do it, okay?
All right, but can we do the thing after that? Because I think they're...
Absolutely, yes. Please, I just have a little errand to run.
Nothing is more important than choosing your dress. Listen, Sahil, Vals, Plight, Madam, Pudding.
That wasn't even a French word. I got confused.
What's a French?
So, Pedro and Brooke spy on what's going on. And they're like, oh, what's going on here? Yeah. I don't know. I do like that, you know, they're asking, like, what kind of dress do you think the groom would prefer? And she's like, I have only met him once. It's like, you know, I do think it's kind of cute that even though both putting in...
Crotchless!
Like, don't want to get...
Someone just shouts it out.
I do like that even though Sanji and Pudding are both like, we don't want to get married! Stop it! They're just like you. It's cute.
Yeah. They have a cute infatuation for one another.
Pedro and Sanji are whispering about this, like, she's trapped here by hand servants, and that means that Sanji probably doesn't know that we're actually even here. But then Brooke says, well, wait... Then who was that guy that Luffy saw on the shore? So they're catching on that there's something going on here. And that's confirmed when Tamago is called outside to discuss some stuff that's going on. These guards call him outside to discuss things. And, let's see. A guard says Peckham's is nowhere to be seen when they showed up here. Four of the Straw Hats are wandering around the seducing woods, and there's no way for them to escape. They're practically as good as caught now. I like how he's got the three wanted posters for Chopper, Luffy, and Nami, and then there's just a little crudely drawn sketch of Carrot that says Buddy Mink on it.
Yeah.
And then there is the poster for Brooke, and then there's Leopard Mink, which is a little bit less crudely drawn picture of Patriot.
Slightly more talent put behind it.
But Baron Tamago corrects them.
That mink is not a leopard. He is a jaguar named Pedro.
You know of him?
We have a past. I believe I have an idea of what he might do. Your squad's job right now is to search for Pecans.
Yes, sir.
Since he was still alive, I had hoped our partnership would go to Mama and plead her forgiveness with him. Such a handful he is. Alas!
Oh, things are looking bad!
Alice!
I was hoping you would do something like that. We cut over to the coast of...
I fucking love that dude for some reason.
Your voice for him is I think, my favorite voice that we do. To Capone... Beige, who is with his wife, another daughter of the Charlotte family, Charlotte Chiffon, and they're with their son, who I like has his own giant cigarette.
It's like a baby cigar.
And has his own One Piece laugh already. Oh, good. So, yeah, they're just hanging out. Alright, this is way too amusing to me. They're just, like, baby talking with their son, and Pickums is there, and he's like, you guys are disgusting! But, Capone, says, well, I gave you your chance, Pickums. As I said back on Zoe, compassion ain't worth a single berry in this world. You ain't cut out for this line of work. This goes to the perfect place to make a body disappear. Let's just say that traces rarely remain. And we cut to down on the shore where these monstrous polka-dotted sharks are jumping out of the water to try and get their prey. And Capone asks if Peckham has any last words. And Peckham says, you don't realize what you're getting into with Mama. And Capone shoots him with a pistol. Peckham falls off the cliff into the water below. I'm sure he's dead. No one could have survived that, Chris.
Yeah, finally another character killed in One Piece. So tragic.
We then cut to inside of Big Mom's throne room, where she is speaking with Caesar Clown. I love this whole sequence. I really do. First off, we find out why Caesar Clown was gigantifying kids. It's because Big Mom's dream, and remember how important dreams are in One Piece, is for all people and races around the world to be a family and sit at the table at the same eye level. And you're the only one who will make that come true, Caesar. I want you to make my family grow to the size of giants with the power of science. That was her goal.
Well, I actually found it kind of compelling and interesting. It's sort of weird because there's always been this unspoken oddness to the size scale of the One Piece world. Oda just consecutively made characters taller and taller until, like, you know, Whitebeard was, I think, like 12 feet tall or something like that, and he wasn't considered a giant or anything like that. He's just that abnormally large. So I actually like the idea that Big Mom's goal is that everyone in her family can sit at a table with this at the same eye level. They can see themselves all as equals, because family seems to be the biggest thing to her. You know, she's always trying to marry her family off and have this big, enormous, you know, family. So I actually kind of like that notion, and it does answer the question of why Caesar Clown was gigantifying people. It's just sort of weird, because I'm like, is this her addressing the fact that she's abnormally large compared to everyone else? Like,
she might be part giant, who knows?
But it's just that thing, there's a ton, like Kaido, also another enormous character, you know, Gecko Moria, another enormous character. Like, there's just a bunch of characters in One Piece who are fucking huge, and I don't know why, like, they never address
why. I mean, it does explain her dream, but I don't want to say, it is kind of sweet in a certain way, but that way is sick and crazy.
Oh, yeah. So she's a fucking insane, like, but I think
the look on her face when she's talking about her dream, you're just like, God. I do love Caesar Clown's, you know, he's just thinking to himself, it's like, yeah, gigantification, this thing, she wants to be able to make ordinary people grow, and that's obviously impossible. I did manage to make kids who are huge, but there's no way that you can actually do it without them dying. So, I pumped this crazy woman for all that she was worth, and called all those girl ships to the island so I could drown in cash, booze, and women.
I love that there's even a thing called girl ships. That there's just boats of women that you pay to have them come. And then they came to Punk Hazard, this terrifying island of fire and ice.
And poison gas.
And monsters.
And he just flat out admitted to himself, that was so great, I just hid in Joker's shadow and got away with whoever I wanted. Who would have guessed that Joker would fall and plunge me into this miserable situation?
It's hard to not find myself becoming slightly sympathetic for Caesar Clown here.
He's just too funny at this point. He is so far removed from that horrible monster who is torturing children at this point, because he's just so fucking wacky now.
It's like, can Caesar become the next Straw Hat?
No.
Fuck you, I don't want my dreams to end here.
Again. So, Caesar Clown goes, listen, it's all the Straw Hat Luffy's fault. I have been working with barely any sleep tirelessly for your sake, Big Mom. And just when my research was about to bear fruit, Straw Hat and Trafalgar Law showed up. If it weren't for them, I'd have completed my gigantism joke by now. Oh, but the advanced research lab built by the world government, oh, it was the perfect environment for you to fashion those results for you. All that funding, the lab contained my work, they're all gone, I can't create the drug anymore. And Big Mom just goes, oh, a lab like Punk Hazard? I built one. What? Yeah, see, I got the blueprints to it ages ago, and my minister of candy can build anything with his candy-making skills. Don't worry, if it won't melt. The candy's been reinforced with iron, and you have unlimited funds at your disposal. So, when are you going to be finished? Oh, God. And, yeah, Caesar Clown just said, a couple of weeks, you know. Oh, my God. So, Caesar Clown's fucking screwed. Hooray. But we are introduced to the Minister of Candy, who is Big Mom's oldest son, Charlotte Perospero. A really freaky-looking dude. Like, if a kid went to Willy Wonka's factory and had nightmares, post-traumatic stress-induced nightmares about the situation afterward, this is probably what they would dream up about it. This guy with this really weird, huge tongue licking this giant candy cane that he carries around.
This is the dude who should have been doing that, like, there's no telling where we're going song.
Exactly, yeah. Willy Wonka turns into this guy when the freaky scenes happen. To get Caesar Clown to continue obeying, he's got his heart, which apparently Sanji just randomly handed off to one of the guys in the ship that took them here. Oh, God. But, yeah, so Caesar Clown's in a dire situation. Didn't think we would have that much set up for him in this arc, but there you go.
They're using them. Can't fault that.
Not forgetting about him. He's been hanging out with his Straw Hats for a while now. Then we cut over to Luffy, who has apparently been going around the seducing woods, gathering up the rest of the Straw Hats, or their clones. And he is so stupid that he doesn't even realize what's going on. He's like, oh, I found some more of them, and they're just all tied up, laying out on the ground. He's just piling them together.
Making fucking animal noises.
Rah, rah, rah. And he's like, why are they acting so weird? What's wrong with you guys? And why aren't you multiplied? Oh, God.
Oh, it was a really good chapter of One Piece this week. I really enjoyed it.
Really entertaining.
A lot of different storylines and characters getting addressed, and it feels like no one's been forgotten. They're even hinting at some stuff with Pedro, like this, you know, this isn't his first time here, and they're addressing that. Brooke's kind of operating that espionage mission right now. It's nice seeing everything kind of get touched upon.
Fun stuff.
I think we should, need to address the new Jumpstart series, The Promised Neverland.
The Promised Neverland. I want this series to be a permanent addition to English Jump.
Really?
I got really hooked on this story. It's not your standard kind of shonen series because...
Not the least.
Well, start off...
You know how Ashirigi Moto, we're like, we want to make a shonen battle series that's not a shonen battle series, a mainstream but not mainstream title? I feel like this is that exactly.
Mm-hmm. It's reminiscent of Obata's art style too. He's not involved in it whatsoever, but a lot of the art really reminded me of it, particularly the hairstyles. We're introduced to this orphanage that our main characters live in. These kids who all dress in white have a seemingly very happy existence. They're all playing around, and our three main characters are these the oldest kids in the group, these 11-year-olds. Ray, Norman, and main character Emma. Everyone's playing around, having fun. You know, they're like, Emma is narrating, saying, you know, everything's, you know, normal to us. I never doubted for 10 years. You know, we would play around. We had a loving mom, the mother superior, basically, of the place. And this was our ordinary daily life. We had warm bed, delicious food, an all-white uniform, IIRRD number on our neck, and the daily test. And everyone's hooked into these goddamn these fucking panels in this suddenly really intense image.
In my wide hell. Eyes, my shadowy. Hell, where it's like, you need to take a test. You have 10 seconds for all these really hard math questions. Why?
10 seconds for these super, like, some of these problems from the looks of them, I think that I could get if I had, you know, several minutes to answer. But these kids, just like, the question barely gets out, and they immediately go, beep, that answer. And the three protagonists all get perfect scores. Again. So, and this is apparently just all normal to them. You know, they don't care about taking these tests because they've been taking them their whole lives. And they're just like, no, this is normal. You know, we get to play around. We get all this freedom and stuff. Except, you know, take this test. And, you know, it's simple. Do-do-do. We get a scene of them playing tag. And Emma explains that there is, like, one particular area that they're not forbidden to go into, and they think it's because it's dangerous. And we get to understand some of their personalities pretty well. They're all very intelligent in slightly different ways. Norman is very strategic-minded, and so, as they explain, Emma can't beat him at tag no matter what. She can beat him in foot races, no problem, but she can't beat him at tag because Norman's a much better strategist than her. And then there is Ray, who just is more antisocial, also very intelligent and strategic, just prefers to sit around reading a book instead. And the big twist happens when one of the girls graduates. She's going to be taken out of the orphanage, and she's taken underground into an area where there's all this blood, and a scythe comes swinging down and spears her through the heart, and then the mother's brother, who is actually brother, comes out and feeds her. No, I'm just kidding. This girl looking like Madeline with that fucking little girl uniform, cuddling her bunny, and she's thinking to herself, oh yeah, I get to go out there, and I get to go out and become an adult, and I want to be a mother like Mom is. But, meanwhile, Norman and Ray and Emma are all thinking to themselves, you know, we've been here longer than a lot of the other kids. You know, we're the oldest ones here, and we still haven't graduated. We still haven't been adopted yet. And she also says, we don't know, no one here knows their real parents or where they were born. And so, you know, being able to go and get a family is a really exciting prospect. It's sad that we have to say goodbye, and we've been here for so long saying goodbye to so many people. But after Connie, the little girl, is taken away, Emma realizes that she's left her stuffed rabbit behind, and they're like, oh, she's already gone. But Ray observes, well, there's a light over there, and so I think that she's actually still on the premises. I don't think she's actually left the compound. And so Norman says, yeah, we should go deliver it to her. And so he and Emma go off in order to do so. Norman, like, picks a lock so that they can get outside. They go to the forbidden area, where they're not supposed to go. And they're looking around trying to find her. You know, saying, like, oh, Connie, where are you? They look in the back of this truck, and Emma reacts in shock, drops the rabbit. They both look inside, and they see Connie's body, wide-eyed, lying in the back of the truck with a flower blooming out of her chest.
And contrary to what you usually get in Jump, they really aren't doing anything to kind of shy away from being kind of morbid and graphic with this. It's a very disturbing shot of clearly a girl's corpse.
But then they hear someone coming, so they both hide underneath the truck as these weird monsters come out. They've got these, like, vertically designed heads, kind of like almost like anteater shaped, and their eyes are aligned vertically instead of horizontally. And so one of them reaches into the truck with these long fingers and picks up Connie's body, and they're like, oh, it looks delicious. And the other one scolds and says, you know, we're not supposed to eat them, come on. And he plops her body into this tube, they still don't know exactly what the hell is going on, as, you know, Emma and Norman are reacting in fear and shock. And they're talking to each other, the demon-looking things are. And they say, come on, you know, we can't mess around with this. You know, this is valuable merchandise, not something the likes of us can have. The human flesh produced by this farm is all high-quality food meant for the rich. So upon learning this, that they are part of a human farm, Emma is like, oh my god, have we just been raised this whole time so that something could eat us? And they also hear a third figure approach saying, yeah, there's another 6-year-old here. All right, we're only shipping on normal ones this time, but soon we're going to be able to harvest some extra high quality ones. Prepare for the plucking of these three that get full marks. Which begs, of course, a lot of questions, because it's like, so are they actually going to eat them? If they are going to eat them, why is it important for the kids to be intelligent? All sorts of...
Yeah, that's definitely a question yet to be answered.
And, of course, it's explained that Mom is working with them, directly with them. She's obeying their directions and such as they head out. The kids are almost discovered, but they manage to get away before one of them actually looks under the truck. They run off. Emma is reacting in shock and denial. She's thinking, that girl in the back of the truck, that wasn't Connie. There's no way that was her. And Norman says, it was her. you know, being the realist in the situation, Jean Minso, Emma lets out this loud cry. They get back, Ray's there to greet them, and he says, "Oh, so how'd it go?" "We didn't make it. They don't say anything about it yet." One of the demons, however, discovers the stuffed rabbit that was left behind and gives it to Mom in order to give it back to her. So the chapter ends with the discussion that Emma and Norman had back before they got back to the bedrooms, which is they've got to get out of there. But Emma insists that they actually rescue the rest of their family, rescue the rest of their kids. So Norman's like, "Don't worry, we'll all escape from here together." And so that's what Rick concludes with them thinking, "We've got to come up with a strategy. We've got to come up with a way for us to survive." I thought this was very compelling. The sense of creepiness from the get-go of like, "Oh, we all were these orphans who we wear white and we hang out together and we take this crazy test." And then building up to the reveal of these demons that fucking eat them.
I like the way they also kind of characterized the three different like leads in this and mm-hmm. established that all of them have their own different way of being intelligent, you know, where Norman is very, you know, strategic and forethinking. Emma has like a lot of physicalness to her, but she is just, you know, intelligent as well. And then the third guy is very book smart. So it seems to be, if this is kind of a battle manga, it's not a battle manga, instead of necessarily having like crazy powers, they might all just be essentially fighting with their logic and their ability to think things out and strategize. Because it seems like that's how they're playing to escape. They're like, "We need strategy." That's sort of an emphasis on things.
And there's also the note, of course, that Emma and Norman are, you know, in on this now. Ray is the third important character, but he doesn't know about this. So how would he react to this? Would he help them? Would he hinder them? What's going to go on?
Yeah.
So I'm very intrigued by this, and I want to see more.
At least do more.
Toriko! Toriko, Toriko, Toriko. So, last time, Neo evolved into a form that was actually scary looking, for once, and proceeded to wreck house. This one opens with the conclusion of the attack on Heracles, whose head falls off. Yay.
Dude, this is like, fuck the eight kings. It's like, four of them I think are just dead at this point.
Neo fights with more of the Eight Kings, like, the Bird King casts its Emperor's Shadow. Neo.
Shocker, shocker, is the Eight King. The Eight King related to Toko is the lamest and most uninteresting member of the Eight Kings.
It leaps up and eats half of the Emperor Crow's body in one bite. The Snake King swallows Neo and tries to basically squeeze it to death inside its own stomach and digest it. Meanwhile, the Blue Nitros are fighting with the Battle Wolves, and one of them betrays the other and kills it.
Well, because they're supposed to represent the different dishes. And he mentions, like, "Hey, if you kill me, then you can be reborn. But Center, you have to die because Acacia needs to eat Center so that he can finish being the full course for Neo to bring it to, like, its full form."
I guess. Yeah. Yeah. Nah, no.
There's something I'm doing off what I vaguely understand about
you will eat this, and then Neo will eat you and all this. Whatever. Yeah. I don't know. Food luck. Turns out that Midora can copy any technique, including food luck. So he's alive.
You know what? It's I couldn't help but still be excited by it. I guess it's because I've grown to like Midora. And I just like that with all the horseshit the villains have, there's one dude that's kind of on the good guy's side who's just like, "I'm horseshit too."
So he's burst out of the can that he was sealed in now. That's it.
I think it's kind of cool. It's hard to really get too excited about the chapter. I'm kind of waiting again. I'm still waiting for things to get consolidated. They're getting there. As I said, like, half of the Eight Kings are dead at this point. I think the deer, horse, Bird and Monkey King are all dead, and that Snake King's not lasting. There's not a moment in my life where I think, oh, you're just going to digest him easily for a billion years. Neo dies. You got him. So, yeah, but I think it should still be interesting to see the next couple chapters.
Mm-hmm. World Trigger, chapter 152, Tamakoma 2, part 17, as the rank wars begin between the three groups. Ikoma Squad has a fourth member. Bullshit.
Yeah, just how it works. I guess
how it works. We have four members. Fuck you.
Yeah, it's hard for me to think, like, why wouldn't... Someone has to address it at some point, because I'm like, why would you not want a fourth member?
What unfolds is a cat and mouse game, as everyone who's got a bagworm immediately cloaks, Usamu and Chika included, and OG Squad immediately is like, okay, let's go track down Usamu. And so it's a lot of it is just them going around everywhere, all around the map, trying to locate him. And they're thinking, okay, well, let's see. Okay, we see Yuma on the map. Judging by the dispersal of different people, there are only so many different places that Usamu can be. And Tamakoma tries to set these traps for them. So there's a bit where Yuma moves to intercept one of them who's heading towards Chika. And they're like, oh, well, I guess that could be that he is going to cover for Usamu, but he could just be trying to make us think that in order to lure us towards Chika and her lead bullet. So they immediately suspect that and head off, and they're like, yeah, you know, there's a building over there that she could snipe us from. It's a little too convenient, so let's head somewhere else and ignore this one. Eventually one of them comes across a bunch of wires that Usamu has set up, and so they're like, okay, yeah, head over here, he's in this area, let's cut him off and let's take him out. They refer to it as his nest, which I like. They converge on Usamu, and he's like, well, shit, I've only set up a little bit more than half of my wires, what should I do? Do I just stop here? Should I engage them until backup arrives? He's like, no. And then he unleashes a blast from his meteor, from his asteroid, rather, and that attracts attention, and so one agent from Ikoma Squad and one agent from OG Squad end up both following around the corner. They stumble across each other, and of course they have to fight. And so because of that, if someone's lured them against each other, and he's like, okay, yeah, I've got to make sure I don't make the same mistake I did last time. I can't get taken out without doing anything.
I love that. I thought that was an awesome moment where he's like, shit, I'm about to get caught. And he's like, I know that this gives away my position, but I will not go down again without doing something, without aiding my team. And this way, I force two of the attackers to go up against one another. Even if I get taken out now, I've changed the course of this battle. I was useful. So I think that's extremely cool.
Mm-hmm. That's it. There's a lot of really details. Cool chapter. There's a lot of details here and there, but they're all centered around one point, which is OG Squad is targeting Usamu, and they're very intelligent. They're not falling for all the obvious tricks. It's very much a chess game that's going on with them. And the fact that Usamu did manage to finally manipulate them at the last second is pretty cool.
Good job, Usamu. You're growing.
Also, by the way, even though Nisekoi is almost done, not a lot happened this week because a lot of it is focused on a montage. The only thing that really happens is Shige goes her own way, and that's why we didn't really cover it. I think that we'll probably end up having some stuff to say next week when it actually finishes, but this was just time-lapsed.
Yeah. Ooh, Nick, maybe that's how we get over next week not having a Bleach Radio topic. We'll just call it Blanisa August.
Oh, God. It'd just be fake blogist.
Yeah. My fake blogist.
All right.
False blogist.
That's all I got to say about manga this week.
Yeah, no. I think this was a decent week. There's some rough chapters in there, but I think the chapters that were good were pretty interesting. I don't think there were more good chapters or chapters I was enjoying than chapters I outright disliked, so.
Mm-hmm.
Good week for Jump.
Alright, let's Let's name our favorites then.
For my chapter of the week, I'm giving to One Piece. I thought One Piece was really enjoyable. I think One Piece is at its best when it's touching on all the different things going on and making it feel like every character involved in this story is important in some way. And I liked how everybody felt like they were getting some kind of touch. You know, Brooke, Pedro, Big Mom, Caesar, everybody had a little bit. And I think just about every storyline they touched on had at least one really good point to it, too. Plus, mm-hmm. I think the villains are really starting to get more interesting.
I would say that One Piece was the best this week if I hadn't read The Promised Neverland. So,
hey, that's fair.
Out of the regular series, I do think that One Piece had the best one this week, but I was really impressed by the new series. I want to see more of it.
This was a very interesting week for our chat room, because My Hero ended up winning. Oh, actually, no. There's been a brand new vote put in. My Hero is tied with One Piece, but, like, right behind them is The Promised Neverland.
And then World Trigger's not very far behind either.
Yeah, this is the first time, though, I think I've seen a jumpstart anywhere close to the number one.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes to say a lot about how people are receiving that. So I guess this is the first tie?
The first ever tie in the poll's history, until someone hears all this and votes in order to...
My Hero.
Yeah. No, too late, guys. Fuck you. All right. My Hero Academia wins so much. Fuck it.
Yeah.
Favorite character I'm going to give to Hatsune from My Hero Academia. Brought a whole bunch of energy and humor to the chapter this week.
I'm going to give mine to Midora from Toriko. I couldn't think of a
good... He did nothing! He showed up!
This was the week that nobody was really that, memorable for me, so I went with the character I guess I got the most excited about, and I was like, cool, Midora's gonna do something! I don't know why I've become a fan of this character, but I have.
Come on, Chris. Ichigo swung his old sword.
Yeah, that's true. She gave it to fucking Uryu. He did something, finally.
Oh my god. Alright. Well, I guess that's it. That's going to do it for Week of Manga Recap. Let's close things out. Thank everyone for joining us here on hitbox.tv/RelloT, where we record the show Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, though sometimes you do need to change things up. So to stay updated on all that stuff, you can follow us on Twitter. We are at WMR Podcast. He is at RelloT. I am at Y Ruler of Time. Check out our past episodes on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com and subscribe to us on our YouTube and on iTunes. Make sure, if you do it on iTunes, to leave a comment and rating so that we can beat the woodworking podcasts.
It's only by your efforts that we can accomplish that dream. Big Mom's dream is to sit at a table and sit eye to eye with all of her family and friends. It's our dream to be better than the woodworking podcasts. You know what? Not even better. Equalish to them. Let's go with that. Equalish to them is something I would appreciate. Actually, we did get a new review from Mariko Suervo. Says, I went to a trip to Japan for 2 weeks at the beginning of June and was super nervous because I needed some podcasts to hear while I was traveling. I typed manga on the iTunes stores and find this podcast. So you guys deserve every support you get.
Thank you very much. It's cool.
Thank you very much. It's much appreciated.
I hope you had a good time in Japan, dude. Mm-hmm. Be sure to send us your criticism, ask us questions, and leave suggestions for future manga for us to read. Send all that stuff to weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com. And keep in mind that this is Blobbist. We are very shortly going to be doing a Bleach-related Q&A as our monthly Q&A. So if you have questions specifically related to that, be sure to send them to us. We've got quite a few that we're going to be going through already, but we want to have some more. And yeah, if you have other questions you want to ask us, we're going to save those for next month.
You still have time to send them in. Like, even if you're listening to this now on iTunes or you're listening to it on YouTube, there's still time to send it in. So.
And also, if you want to help Chris to create his Trollo-T trivia contest for this month's bonus podcast, the Bleach trivia contest between myself and Ticking, which I might be able to get, like, a tenth of his score. I don't know.
With Trollo-T's trivia, Nick, anything is possible.
It's possible. Yeah, go contact Chris through that and say you want to help out. Special thanks go out to our Patreon supporters. Your support allows us to create all sorts of bonus content for you guys to enjoy. We recently did a commentary on the fantastic adventures of Unico.
That was a trip and a half. It was a super fun commentary for something we knew nothing about going into it. I highly recommend you check that out, because it is... You can see the movie on Crunchyroll. Like, you can stream it there. And it's such a weird movie.
Thanks, Guap.
Baron Ghost's plan, Nick. I don't understand.
Why can't Akuma go with Unico? Special thanks as well go out to Steve Man, our tower card artist. He was very happy to draw these giant tits you see above our heads.
Yeah, it was like a last minute, like I had some trouble contacting him, so the last one was like, hey, it is short notice, we're doing zombie powder, you think you can get something out for it? He's like, yeah, I'll see, you know, I'll have to see what my schedule is. He's like, oh wait, there's a tit monster in this. Yeah, I'll get that in 10 seconds for you, boss.
Is tit monster his term or yours?
I believe that is actually quite literally what he said in regards to it. I believe he called her like a tit monster or tit beast or something like that.
I don't know. Kubo did in the additional materials blatantly say that she's like a 100 centimeter H cup. So, yeah. Oh god. And thanks as well, of course, go out to Infamous Planet. He made the frame that you see around us now. And sorry, that's so funny to me for some reason.
Tit monster.
More Bloggist will be coming up next week and the rest of the month. I'm looking forward to it. I hope you guys are looking forward to it too. We'll see you next time.
Wait, what's our next recommendation?
I haven't picked it out yet. Shut up.
But I'm on pins and needles.
We'll figure it out. Hang on.
All right, fine. One of many stupid fucking. Recommendation. You know, we were 74th on iTunes Top Hobby Podcast, Nick.
Yeah, okay.
But it's this kind of professionalism that's going to drop us right back down to 69. Wait, that's higher. 77. That's lower. Yes, 77, Nick. We're going to drop 3 spots.
Oh, no.
Hope you're proud of yourself.
A little bit.
There we go.
Alright.
That is going to do it, everybody, for Weekly Manga Recap this week. I hope all of you enjoyed the episode this week. I hope you all had fun. For things that are going to be coming up, as Nick mentioned prior to the episode, the WMR movie commentary from last month is up on Patreon. Again, you don't need to be a patron to see it. You don't even need a Patreon account. Everybody can view it. You can download it for free there. What else was going on? I know I had more stuff to bring up. There was a new episode of Super Larry's Brothers went up last night. Every Tuesday night, new episode, superlariousbros.podbean.com. You can find it on iTunes. I believe we're going to be doing a D&D game this Saturday, and there may be one this Friday as well. Not 100%, okay. But sometime coming up.
Awesome.
And maybe doing a manga-related LP sometime soon. There's something I caught that caught my attention that I may be playing. It'll be stupid as shit, but I might give it a try. So I can't guarantee when that's going to be. Time is a precious resource, but something might happen. Anything from you, Nick?
Not a whole lot going on right now. Eventually, because my schedule is going to be changing around the end of the month, and when that happens, that means I'll probably be getting up to some more stuff during the weekend, be doing my other podcast more regularly. I'd be getting to hang out with Chris more, honestly. But until that happens, I'm still not going to be doing a whole lot of stuff other than WMR.
Gotcha. Well, there's some cool stuff going on, guys. And, of course, we got some really cool stuff coming up on the horizon. We'll have an episode of Tekken coming up sometime very soon. The really awesome bonus pod I'm super excited for. Bloggers is going to be sweet, guys. So I hope all of you enjoyed the episode this week. I hope all of you had fun. Thank you all for watching. We'll catch you next time right here. Hitbox.tv/RollerT. Have a good one, everybody.
Goodbye.